me, son of man, set your face against Gog, and of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Prophesy against him, and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out with your whole army, your horses, your horsemen fully armed, and a great horde with large and small shields, all of them brandishing their swords. Persia, Cush, and Put will be with them, all with shields and helmets, also Gomer, with all its troops, and with Beth-Hogmer from the far north with all its troops, the many nations with you. So we see it's a huge, gigantic army. Get ready, be prepared, you and all the hordes gathered about you, and take command of them. After many days you will be called to arms. In future years you will invade a land that has recovered from war, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which have long been desolate. They had been brought out from the nations, and now all of them live in safety. You and all your troops and the many nations with you will go up, advancing like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land. This is what the sovereign Lord says. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind, and you will devise an evil scheme. You will say, I will invade a land of unwalled villages. I will attack the peaceful and unsuspecting people, all of them living without walls and without gates and bars. I will plunder and loot and turn my hand against the unsettled ruins and the people gathered from the nations, rich in livestock and goods, living at the center of the land, Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, and all her villages will say to you, have you come to plunder? Have you gathered your hordes to loot, to carry off silver and gold, to take away livestock and goods, and to seize much plunder? Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to God, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In that day, when my people Israel are living in safety, you will not take notice of it. You will come from your place in the far north, you and many nations with you, all of them riding on horses, a great horde, a mighty army. You will advance against my people Israel like a cloud that covers the land. In days to come, O Gog, I'll bring you against my land, so that the nations may know me when I show myself holy to you before their eyes. Well, that's the first 16 verses of Ezekiel and should pretty well set before you this prophecy. When I was initially asked to take this subject, my first impression was, this will be a piece of cake. However, the sources which I generally rely upon for guidance very quickly changed my mind. For example, A.M. Morse, in his book Prophecy Unveiled, commented upon every major prophecy until he reached Ezekiel 38-39. And his comments were, in chapters 38-39, there is an obscure prediction, evidently relating to the future and not sufficiently fulfilled to be identified in history. Suffice it to say, this was a severe setback for me in my research upon this subject. Upon this prophecy. Another source said, this is allowed to be the most difficult prophecy in the Old Testament. It is difficult to us because we know not the king nor people intended by it. But I am satisfied they were well known by these names in the time that the prophet wrote. Therefore, it is with a great deal of caution and some degree of reluctance that I approach this subject today. Nevertheless, I feel comfortable with the conclusion that I reach concerning this prophecy. The other day, when I gave it up at Tulsa, I went into a great deal more background than I'm going to today, considering the audience. But I would like to point out at the very outset, and this will be repeated one more time, that it's very important and very essential to understand who Ezekiel is. Particularly, it's important to realize that he is a prophet of God to the exiles in Babylonian captivity. Now, although Ezekiel prophesied, as far as his prophecies are concerned in the Bible, the way that they've been incorporated in the Bible precedes Daniel. Daniel, though, preceded Ezekiel into Babylonian captivity by 8 years. So we know that during the reign of Jehoiakim, and I generally call this one I call Kim, and this one I call Chim, because I don't know that I'm pronouncing them correctly. But according to my information, Jehoiakim, during the reign of Jehoiakim, Daniel was taken captive, along with some of the very best of the children of Israel. He went into the area where the headquarters, the palace of the king, is located. Now, some 8 years later, this is also in Jeremiah. Jeremiah calls Jehoiachin, C-H-I-N, the way it ends. He calls him Jeconiah and Coniah. They're all the same person. And 8 years later, he reigned for 3 months. He was taken into captivity. And when he went into captivity, Ezekiel was taken into captivity with him. So you see, there's a first siege when Daniel went into Babylonian captivity, and he went into a different area there than Ezekiel did. Now, when Ezekiel was taken into Babylonian captivity, he was taken to an area somewhat like 200 miles north of Babylon, in the area of Masphetonia, and along the river Kabar. Now, when he prophesied, Ezekiel did, to those exiles in that area of the captivity. So he, Ezekiel, was a prophet to the exiles in Babylonian captivity, particularly those located near the river Kabar. According to some authorities, in that captivity, there were around 3,000 who went into that captivity. Now, according to Jeremiah, I believe it's Jeremiah 24, where he speaks of the two baskets of figs, one good, one bad. Those involved in that particular prophecy were Daniel and Ezekiel. They were good. And in that first two sieges of the land of Judah, the very best of those people were taken into captivity in these first two sieges. Now, Zedekiah, in the 11th year and the 5th month, you can read it, just spells it out very clearly in the Bible, exactly how long he reigned when Nebuchadnezzar came down and he wiped up or took the rest, except some of the poorest that he left behind to, of course, look after the vineyards and so forth. So the rest went into captivity in the 3rd siege. So there's 3 sieges in the Babylonian captivity. Now, most people and most authorities mark the beginning of this captivity with the last one. When the city itself was plundered, the temple was destroyed, the houses burned, the gates destroyed, that's when they really reckon Babylonian captivity as initially beginning, but it did have its beginning much before that time. As a matter of fact, Ezekiel was in captivity 5 years before he began to prophesy. Now, to me, it's very relevant, very important to understand what I've just stated. It's very significant, and I think you'll see why as we go along. Also, I want to point out, it comes to my mind, that Ezekiel was contemporary with Jeremiah. Jeremiah, at the very same time, was prophesying to Judah, the ones that remained. Jeremiah was prophesying to them. He said, you might as well give up. You're not going to win. And the people, really the Jews, hated Jeremiah. And when they went into captivity, he did not go with them into captivity. Matter of fact, he went to Egypt down there, and 2 years later, so he was murdered. That's Jeremiah. Jeremiah is contemporary with Ezekiel, but remember, Jeremiah was a prophet to Judah, the tribe, the part of Judah that remained around Jerusalem. Now, back to my notes. Gog, this is what you all want to know about. Gog is mentioned in 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 4 as the name of a Reubenite. Until you reach, in your reading of the Old Testament, Ezekiel chapter 38, there's not another mention of Gog in the Old Testament. Now, it is my position, and it's based upon some authorities too, that it is probably referred to in Ezekiel, since it's not mentioned any other time other than the 1 Chronicles 5 and 4. It is probably referred to in Ezekiel as the name which Ezekiel has arbitrarily formed from the name of the country of Magog. So in our study today, I simply believe that it's just a form of the term Magog as used in Ezekiel 38. And there's no real significance to that name other than it's just an arbitrary form. Ezekiel chose to do it that way, of Magog. Now, what about Magog? As for Magog in Genesis the 10th chapter, verse 3, and also 1 Chronicles chapter 1 and verse 5, Magog is the name of a person. It's quite interesting, and I love to do this anyway, and sometimes I give lessons along this line. He is of the ancestry of Japheth, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, to recall. The son of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madi, Havan, Tubal, Meshach, and Tyrus, or his ancestry, the ancestry, and the lineage of Japheth. Generally, listen now, generally the lineage of Japheth was blessed. And why is that? In Genesis chapter 9, Japheth was blessed with Shem, and Canaan was cursed. Verse 24, 27, extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave. Since Magog isn't mentioned again by name until Ezekiel's prophesies again in Ezekiel 38, 39, I can only conclude that through the centuries, as Magog's descendants increased and as they grew into a nation, that they had become idolatrous. If you've ever studied the blessing and the curse concept or principle, this would be easily understood. If a nation, individuals whose ancestry developed into a nation, you could readily predict the outcome of that nation. As a result, because apparently he did go into idolatry, they incurred the curse of God. In Ezekiel 38, verse 15, you will come from your place in the far north, he says, you and many nations with you, all of them riding horses, a great horde, a mighty army. Now, Mr. Meade believed that the Scythians, S-C-Y-T-H-A-N-S, who were descendants of Magog, son of Japheth, meant the Americans. Since the Americans were originally colonies of the Scythians. Holligan, on the other hand, declares for the Scythians, whose neighbors were people of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. That is, Russia, the Muscovites, and Tiberini, or the Cappadocians. This is according to Clark's commentary. Remember, though, the peoples represented are not named in this prophecy. The peoples represented, we don't know. We have to figure them out. These names, though, were well known in the time when the prophet wrote. There's no two ways about that. Now, as we've already pointed out, I want to review again that, and I told you I would repeat it for emphasis' sake. It is important to realize that Ezekiel was a prophet to the exiles in Babylonian captivity. This is found in Ezekiel 1:1. Ezekiel went into Babylonian captivity with the second group taken from Judah. This group of captives were taken to a place about 200 miles north of Babylon on the river Kabar. If you recall, the first captivity included Daniel, and this captivity occurred about 8 years before the one which Ezekiel was taken into captivity. It is clear, according to Ezekiel chapter 2, that he was called to prophesy to the exiles in captivity. You need to read chapter 2. It's very clearly evident that this is the case. This is a very, very significant consideration in our study today. Now, what I would like to do, using Kyle DeLeish paraphrasation of these verses, I would like to read a paraphrasation of 38 and 39, putting it out more in focus. Gog, the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, will invade the restored land of Israel from the far distant northern land by the appointment of God in the last times and with a powerful army of numerous nations. Chapter 38, verse 1 to 9, that's a paraphrasation of it. With the intention of plundering Israel, now dwelling in security, that the Lord may sanctify himself upon him before all the world. This is a paraphrasation of verses 10 to 16. But when God, of whom earlier prophets have already prophesied, let me read that again. It's important. But when Gog, of whom earlier prophets have already prophesied, shall fall upon Israel, he is to be destroyed by a wrathful judgment from the Lord. Copyist misspelled that. Now, that the nations may know that God is the Lord. Verses 17 and 23. On the mountains of Israel will Gog with all his host and nations succumb to the judgment of God. Chapter 39, verses 1 through 8. The inhabitants of the cities of Israel will spend 7 years, there's your seven again, in burning the weapons of the fallen foe, and 7 months in burying the corpses in a valley, which will receive its name from this so as to purify the land, verses 9 to 16. Whilst in the meantime, all the birds and the wild beasts will satisfy themselves with the flesh and blood of the fallen. Verses 17 to 20. By this judgment will all the nations, as well as Israel, know that it was on account of its sins that the Lord formerly gave up Israel into the power of the heathen, but that now he will no more forsake his redeemed people because he has poured out his spirit upon it. Verses 21, 29. Now, if you've heard Herbert W. Armstrong in the, as he prophesies, whatever you call what he does, the world tomorrow, I've heard him say that he believes that Gog and Magog is Russia. Well, I've already told you that Holligan takes that view. Another fellow takes the view that it's America. Well, I hope not to disappoint you. I don't think it's any of those people or nations. I'm going to tell you why. First, let me give you a position that's entirely figurative. I do not take a figurative view of these verses at all, as far as the final interpretation of them are concerned. I don't think you're going to have any trouble knowing where I stand in just a little bit. Figurative or literal application. Mr. Barnes says it is a gathering together of the enemies of Jehovah to make their last efforts and to be overthrown. The seer passes to the final struggle between good and evil and the triumph establishment of divine rule. It is the same struggle which is depicted in the book of Revelation chapter 20, 7 to 10, where John adopts words and phrases of Ezekiel. While John in Revelation did use, now this is my comment, now this is not Barnes, while John in Revelation did use words and phrases of Ezekiel's prophecy, I do not believe that Ezekiel is prophesying or predicting a figurative event over 2,000 years in the future. Notice whom he is prophesying to. The time and circumstances and purposes of Ezekiel's prophecy indicates this prophecy had a fulfillment in the near future from the time he wrote. Some of the best scholars apply the prophecy to Antiochus Epiphanes. Historically, Antiochus fulfills most of the details of this prophecy. I do believe this prophecy had a literal fulfillment, and it is my position today that Antiochus does fulfill the prophecy in a more complete way than any other person of that time, although those other positions taken by other people. It is my belief that he most nearly fulfills this prophecy. However, there are some passages that are difficult to explain in taking this position. Almost always you will have problems with any position that you take. First, notice Ezekiel chapter 38, 1 to 2, to put it in now this into perspective. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Now, in taking the position that I'm taking this afternoon, Gog, the prince, represents Antiochus Epiphanes. My understanding is Epiphanes, or however you pronounce it, is the surname of Antiochus. Magog represents Syria. That's the country to the far north. Syria was the land that was to the far north of Judea. About 400 years after Ezekiel wrote, Antiochus did attack Judea, and much of what Ezekiel prophesied did occur during that siege. Here is the biggest difficulty now in taking this position. It's found in chapter 38 and verse 11. You will say, I will invade a land of unwalled villages. I will attack the peaceful and unsuspecting people, all of them living without walls, without gates and bars. This seems to allude to spiritual Israel after the Messianic kingdom was established. However, if you will note, verse 20, there were walls which crumbled when the Lord attacked God. What could have happened is that the Israelites had built and inhabited territories in the mountains and plains away from the old walled cities, and this was the prime target of Antiochus when he attacked Judea. Another passage which causes some difficulties, some for others who takes a different position, and on the other hand it might cause my situation to have some problems, is verse 17. Here it is. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Are you not the one I spoke of in former days by my servants, the prophets of Israel? At that time, they prophesied for years that I would bring them against them. Now, the question is, what prophets prophesied before concerning this situation? Now, you see, Ezekiel says that there were prophets who prophesied before about this. So that to me makes my situation somewhat easier. Now, if Antiochus is Gog, then Ezekiel prophesied against him. Since Ezekiel was prophesying about a situation that occurred nearly 400 years after the fact, after he wrote it, or after he prophesied it. Since Ezekiel prophesied almost 400 years before this happened. Also, another was Daniel. Now you remember Daniel prophesied actually contemporarily with Ezekiel, but he did prophesy about the same situation. In other words, he prophesied about the kingdom to the far north and the kingdom to the south. And it was alluded to this morning. And matter of fact, I agreed exactly with what was said this morning concerning chapter 11. There, we have Antiochus. He purposed to invade and destroy Egypt, as was very clearly brought out. And it was accurate, as far as I can tell. But in doing so, his intentions were, and it affected Judah. After considering various propositions and especially the context text of Ezekiel 38-39, only a literal fulfillment of this prophecy sometime In the near future, from the time Ezekiel wrote, was the design and purpose of this prophet, since his people, God's people, were going to be attacked. And if Antiochus isn't, I want you to listen to this now, and if Antiochus isn't the Gog intended, then some other historical situation of that time was. Now, that's my exact position. Now, in other words, what I'm saying is that this here is a literal prediction that Israel would be attacked, although it's couched in greatly highly symbolic language. Now, I want to take up something else. Now, somebody says this surely must have been a type, antitype prophecy. Well, I'm now going to reveal to you my position on types and antitypes. Well, I do not believe as a whole this was a type and antitype prophecy. Let me quote to you something A.M. Moore says concerning types and antitypes to help clarify it. The whole system of types ceased to be effective in that nation, Israel, when the gospel of Christ went into effect and they're actually the apostles. Hence, the primary question to be determined is as to the nature and duration of the heavenly types. Each type was, in an important sense, a prophecy. It was not an end, but a means to an end. When we have learned that these types were local in nature and not universal, that they were for the fleshly descendants of Abraham and only for a given time, this limitation was to those who lawfully used them, and the time when they were to cease even for them prepares the way, as nothing else can, to understand the prophecies relating to the same time and people and to their later history. Is it not self-evident that if the type ceased with the introduction of the gospel, that all prophecy must and does harmonize with this controlling fact? Preface, page 8 of A.M. Morse's book, Prophecy Unveiled. Mr. Morse, if you've ever read after him, he's very good in substantiating his positions with facts. Morse substantially documents with many scriptural proofs his position, particularly regards to types. So if Brother A.M. Morse is correct, I cannot fault his conclusions, and if Ezekiel 38:39 was, in fact, an anti-type situation, which I don't think it is, that wouldn't help anybody either if they tried to apply it today. The types were legislated away in the antitype when the gospel age went into effect. So this prophecy, applying this system of interpretation, the type and antitype situation, would not extend to this time because they were filled at the outset of the gospel age. Now let me allude to, it's not on my notes, but I want to tell you that, give you an example of what I'm talking about. David is a type of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is the antitype, and he fulfilled that type. Now, once Jesus Christ came, he legislated forever away that type. It no longer goes beyond Jesus Christ. There was a type and an antitype. Elijah is prefigured as a type of John the Baptist. In John 1, though, John says, I am not that prophet, but he was a type of it. In other words, he was the antitype of Elijah. And so in that sense, it could be said symbolically and figuratively that Elijah was John the Baptist. But John the Baptist was only that is in an antitype situation. He fulfilled it. And when he fulfilled that prophecy in that sense and that type, he forever legislated it away. It never went beyond that. That's what I mean, that they ceased in the gospel age. You can take the nation of Israel, the land of Israel is a type of spiritual Israel. But when the spiritual Israel came into existence, that type ceased to exist forever. And so it is, if a person takes that this is a type, antitype situation, it's legislated away then, and understanding types, and I think we should understand them, that would be the case here too. Very briefly, somebody might say now, You've made your case clear. I thought you would say a lot more about it and probably make it America or Russia or somebody like that. I don't think that it will. It's just this prophecy is a prediction, and it ended there. But somebody's going to say, what about Revelation 27:10, where it's referred to? Well, you can ask me all you want to about this whenever a question and an answer period comes. Very briefly, though, I'll tell you what I think. First, I'm going to put it in my own words, and maybe I'll read to you. I had thought about just going over Revelation 20 and taking the first 10 verses and making comments on it. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say that I simply believe that when John, the Revelator, wrote, he had Daniel's prophecies in mind, and he had Ezekiel's particularly. When he wrote Revelation chapter 20, it's so quite self-evident that he had Ezekiel chapter 37 about the valley there, the dead bones there, and that valley that came to life. I believe when the first part of Revelation 20 was given, he alludes to that situation because he talks about it there, about the first resurrection. Then he applied second resurrection. Those two resurrections are figurative resurrections. If you want to know what I believe they are, you can ask me about them later. But you know he had Ezekiel's writing in front of him because he alludes to chapters 38 and 39 about this great confrontation between the good and evil, and the rider of the white horse with a sword from his mouth will slay all the evil, all the wickedness that in the little season that was loose to fight against the church. And they were all cast into, it's highly symbolic language, into the lake of fire. And then this, of course, involves the second death and the only literal resurrection of the entire Bible at the end of the world occurs. Well, if you want me to read my notes, I'll just give you a little bit more on that, and I'm going to be done. Very briefly, I will paraphrase Revelation 21-10. It seems that John is following Ezekiel's writings closely, especially chapters 37. The bottomless pit represents all forms of wickedness, idolatry, superstition, false religious leaders, and so forth. The chain represents the Word of God. In Revelation chapter 9-2, the bottomless pit was opened, and here in chapter 20 it is sealed and closed. Papal Rome, the Mohammedan scourge and religious tyranny on a worldwide scale, had been broken and defeated. In a sense, this type of wickedness was dead. The Word of God was being proclaimed now throughout the whole world. So the devil, the source of wickedness, was cast into the bottomless pit, and the seal was placed upon it for 1,000 years. So in Revelation 9:2, the bottomless pit, or the bath, was opened. 1,260 years later, it was closed for 1,000 years. During this period, the righteous dead lived through the lives of those proclaiming the gospel around the world. This was the first resurrection of Revelation 20 and verse 4. The second resurrection after the 1,000 years implied in verse 4 was the wicked, a figurative resurrection. After this 1,000 years was over, wickedness of all kinds, with religious tyranny influenced by the devil, who was no longer bound in the abyss, would wage a relentless war for a little season until the Word of God would virtually destroy him forever. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. In number, they are like the sand of the seashore. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surround the camp of God's people, the city he loves. The fire came down from heaven and devoured them, and the devil deceived them, was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur with the beast and the false prophets, where the beast and the false prophets have been thrown. They will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Revelation chapter 27-10. So there are three resurrections in Revelation 20. The first two are figurative, separated by 1,000 years. The first of the righteous, the second of the wicked. And then the third resurrection is a literal resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. And there is only one literal resurrection, and it is at the end of the world. Revelation 20:11-15, Job 14:10-2. Therefore, my conclusion is Ezekiel 38:39 is a prediction prophecy, not involving type or antitype, and that John is... In Revelation, simply use the language Ezekiel in his prophecy there. That's the way I understand it all. So I'm now ready for questions.